diatribe genre by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract. A sketch of this quasi-genre, a teaching and exhortation technique that was developed by the Greeks and found considerable use in early Christian writings, especially those of Paul and James. Here we illustrate this method from the letter of James. The word diatribe has very different meaning in literary and circles relating to antiquity and in modern common usage. The common definition for diatribe is a bitter abusive criticism or denunciation. The historical or literary definition, a method or mode of teaching and exhortation used in the ancient schools of philosophy. This second meaning will be what we are using here. Brief history of diatribe. It originated among those traveling philosophers, teachers that we call the Sophists, sometime before 200 BC. That would be after Plato and Aristotle's time. It was later adopted by other philosophical schools, the Cynics and the Stoics, and it was used by traveling philosophers who taught on a popular level. It's not technically a literary genre. That's why I called it a quasi-genre in our abstract there, but an oral teaching method. Typically a lecture or writing on moral or philosophical topics that would be of popular interest, so used by traveling philosophers who taught on a popular level, and then later by those who wrote up their material. Common topics of ancient diatribes include divine providence, self-control, self-sufficiency. So they were, in some sense, perhaps the self-help type lecturers of the ancient Greco-Roman world. The philosopher Epictetus, AD 55 to 135, is especially noted for his use of this method. In the New Testament, diatribe is especially used by Paul and James. Characteristics of diatribe. As I said, it's not strictly a genre. It has no set structure like a letter would, or a Greco-Roman letter, or a parable. It uses the features of dialogue, that is, the genre of writing in which you have a conversation back and forth between two particularly people, or sometimes more. And it also uses the features of rhetoric, the name given to both the activity of public speaking and the theory and practice behind Greco-Roman public speaking. The dialogue features would be imaginary opponents or speakers are brought into the lecture or the writing to represent various comments or points of view, that sort of thing. Often a question and answer format is used, and various hypothetical objections that one might have to the points the speaker or writer is making will be considered as features of a diatribe. A diatribe as a teaching and exhortation method typically operates by refuting or rejecting false conclusions that might be drawn from some topic or that the speaker or writer is dealing with, or some matter that has come up at this point in the writer's development. Besides these features of dialogue, the technique of diatribe also has a number of features of rhetoric. It uses the standard features that are recognized in Greco-Roman public speaking. One of these is amplification, where a writer will make a statement and then add additional details to it or develop it in some way to be better understood. Personification, a figure of speech in which a thing or quality or idea is represented as a person. A maxim or proverb is often used in rhetoric and in dialogue as well. A concise statement of general truth or a concise statement of rule or rule of conduct. Censure and praise is another feature in which the speaker in a Greco-Roman talk, speech, will give a negative or positive evaluation of some matter that he has come to, and this is carried over in diatribe, and basically the intention is to convey to the listener or the reader the opinion of the speaker, writer, regarding this particular matter, and making it clear that the person has negative or positive evaluation of this. Just as in rhetoric, a good deal of use was made of a saying or action of a famous person, so this is also done in diatribe as well. And in comparison, a rather common feature of much teaching and lecture anyway, is carried over to diatribe. Historical examples, again, looking to some famous event or some famous person in history as either a good example that we should imitate or a bad example that we should avoid. Lists of virtues or vices. You'll see this now and again in both Paul and James, that to give you a vivid picture of a certain type of person or a certain type of worldview or attitude, the speaker writer will list a group of virtues that characterize that or a group of vices that characterize that. Parallelism, of course, is something none of these are new to diatribe, but the kind of clumping together is new. Parallelism, a feature of rhetoric, a feature that we would be familiar with from the poetry of the Old Testament, finds considerable use in ancient and in modern rhetoric, for that matter, particularly in sermons, and that is used as well in diatribe. And then antithesis, where one uses a parallelism but contrasts opposites rather than successive lines which have similar meaning or similar features. Irony, another feature of rhetoric that's carried over into diatribe, a statement in which the intended meaning by the speaker-writer is the opposite of the usual sense. So you would catch that more easily by the tone of voice of the speaker when it's spoken. When it's written, one must depend upon knowing where the speaker or the writer is coming from and seeing how this fits in with the context of what the speaker or writer has been saying. Then sarcasm, a taunting, sneering, cutting remark of some sort, is another feature of both rhetoric and diatribe. And then paradox, a statement which seems contradictory or unbelievable or absurd, but is actually true. And that is something that, again, goes back to Proverbs in the Old Testament and was a feature of Greco-Roman rhetoric and now comes over into diatribe. What we see here, I think, is that both Paul and James are using features that a number of them have some background in the Old Testament, but also are up to date in the sense that that is the way that public speakers and teachers were operating at New Testament times as well, so they made use of these particular techniques. And if we're on the lookout for these, it'll help us to understand what's going on quite frequently. Now what we want to do is look at diatribe in James, and we're not going to do anything thorough, but just look at some examples. And we're going to show you some pages from a copy of the letter of James. And the dialogue type features we're going to show you in yellow. Personification and lists of virtues and vices we'll do in red or pink. Maxims or proverbs we'll do in green. And historical examples or sayings of famous people we will put in blue. And irony we will put in orange. So what I'll be doing here, for those of you who are trying to run the PowerPoint and listen to this lecture at the same time, is I'll go through these five or so pages and look at the yellow items and then come back and look at the red and pink items and then the green items and the blue items and the orange items. So we'll be going back and forth on these now. Here's the first page of James, and we're looking for yellow at this point, which is the dialogue type features, And notice here on in 1:13 that James is saying, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. So he's bringing up here a imaginary speaker, this person, who's going to say, God is tempting me, that's why I'm having this trouble. And he's refuting it, so false conclusion refuted is what we're seeing here as well, a feature of rhetoric. But he does it by means of having a speaker come. Moving down to our second page in 2:2, we have, suppose a man comes into your meeting wearing gold ring and fine clothes, and a poor man in shabby clothes also comes in. If you show special attention to the man wearing fine clothes, say, here's a good seat for you, but say to the poor man, you stand there, or sit on the floor by my feet. So a nice example of using speakers, interlocutors, we might say, to give a dialogue-type flavor to what's going on here, dramatic flavor, if you like. Notice over in later in the chapter, there in verse 16, what good is it, my brothers, if a man claims to have faith but has no deeds? Can such faith save him? Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes or daily food. If one of you says to him, go, I wish you well, keep warm and be well and well fed, does nothing about his physical needs, what good is it? Okay, so again, use of this a dialogue technique. And over here in 2:18, someone will say, you have faith, I have deeds. And then over in chapter 4, verse 13, now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow, we'll go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money. So there's a speaker, again, an interlocutor, if you like, an imaginary speaker is invented here. And then the false conclusion refuted in the very next verse, you don't even know what'll happen tomorrow, okay? That's just what you're going to do in a year, okay? Instead, you ought to say, if it's the Lord's will, we will live and do this and that. So a reminder by James, put in the form of a dialogue of imaginary speakers, that our lives are in God's hands. We do not even know what tomorrow will bring. And so a reminder of that, keeping that in mind, and even expressing that verbally is helpful. Well, that's our tour of James for those dialogue-type features in yellow. Now let's look at two somewhat different types of sort of things, personification in red or pink, and lists of virtues or vices. Here we are in the beginning of James again, and consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, 1:2, because the testing your faith produces perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete. You're getting a personification. And then over in 1:14, in response to this claim that somebody might say, God is tempting me, basically James says, God can't be tempted by evil, nor does it tempt anyone. Each is tempted when, by his own evil desire, he's dragged away and enticed. So evil desire is pictured as perhaps a kidnapper or something of that sort, dragged away and enticed, maybe a rapist even. Then after desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. So we've got evil desire, perhaps less a kidnapper than a harlot or something of that sort, and then desire conceives, and it gives birth to sin, and sin is the child, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. So you've got desire, sin, and death personified. I'll go over a couple more panels. And the tongue, 3:5, is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Okay, there's an example of personification of the tongue, if you like. Now, switching to the other use that we've been making of pink, down at the bottom of that page, 2:13, and such, we've got a list of virtues and vices. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show it by his good life, by deeds done in humility that comes from wisdom. So, a good life, good deeds, humble deeds, deeds done in wisdom. And then you get your vices. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Kind of list of vices there. Both those are rather short lists at this particular point. But then a rather nice longer list of virtues is in 317, next panel. But the wisdom that comes from above is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. There are a picture of a list of virtues and vices. And you see that rather frequently in Paul as well. Back to personifications, 4:4, you adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world is hatred towards God? Anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world. So the idea that the world is your friend, personification. And then over right at the end of our panel and into the next panel in 5:3, their corrosion, the corrosion of your wealth, your gold and silver are corroded, their corrosion will testify against you. So the corrosion of your wealth, the fact that the wealth has been hoarded and not been used, and not been used in a good way, will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. Look, the wages you have failed to pay the workmen who mowed your fields are crying out against you. So the corrosion of the wealth is testifying and is eating your flesh, and the wages are crying out against you, personifications. Go back again to our lists and look at the third item now. Maxims or proverbs in green. Lots of these in James, as we'll see looking here. Look at the first page, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 places I've got marked here. I'm not sure I've got them all. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds. A maxim, a little short statement of a truth. Notice it's also a paradox. Pure joy when you face trials, okay? And then down in, that's 1:2. Then down in 1:9 and 10, the brother in humble circumstances ought to take pride in his high position, but the one who is rich should take pride in his low position. Again, a maxim, a paradox, that a person who is poor should take pride, and a person who is rich should take pride in a low position, his humility, and his humbleness, if you like. An antithesis between high circumstances and low position, wealth and poverty, if you like. Another maximum in 1:12, blessed is the man who perseveres under trial. And then in 1:19, dear brothers, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. It's a command. It's also a maxim, okay? How do you conduct your life? Well, be ready to listen, but not so ready to speak, and not ready to become angry. Not that you never become angry and never speak, okay? 1:22, don't merely listen to the word and so deceive yourself. Do what it says, right? Maximal, huh? And also a false conclusion refuted, that listening to the word is good enough, if you like, huh? And then in 1:25, James has just given a picture back in 1:24 of anyone who listens to the word but doesn't do what he says. He's amplifying, do what it says. And he's doing it by means of a comparison. Anyone who listens to the word but does not do what it says is like a man who looks at his face in a mirror, and after looking at himself, goes away and immediately forgets what he looks like. So a person who hears the word but doesn't do it doesn't really learn what kind of a person he is. Verse 25. The man who looks intently into the perfect law that gives freedom and continues to do this, not forgetting what he's heard, but doing it, he will be blessed in what he does. This is rather a complicated figure, but it's basically saying that when we look at ourselves in a mirror and then go away, we kind of forget what we look like. But if you hold a mirror in front of you all the time, you remember what you look like. Well, a person who hears what the Scripture teaches, what the law teaches, but doesn't try to do it, doesn't realize what he's really like. The person who not only continues to pay attention to what the law teaches, but then tries to put it into practice, that person realizes what he's like. The law becomes a mirror to him. The law shows up his sins, okay, and shows he's nowhere near as good as he thinks he is otherwise. Mm-hmm. Here's another example of a maxim, verse 27. religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. 2:1, don't show favoritism. And look in 2:13, judgment without mercy will be shown to anyone who has not been merciful. Mercy triumphs over judgment. Or 1:17, faith by itself, if it is not accompanied by action, is dead. Then in 2:24, a person is justified by what he does and not by faith alone. This sounds very antithetical to Paul, and we'll try and come back and discuss that when we discuss the letter of James in general. James believes he's using justified a little differently than Paul is. Paul's using justified to mean declared righteous by God, and James, I think, would agree with that as well. But he's also talking about what shows us to be that we are accepted by God. A person is justified by what he does and not by faith alone. What shows us to be righteous people is not professions to belief, but our lifestyle. 26, another one of these maxims. As the body without spirit is dead, so faith without deeds is dead. It's the deeds that show that faith is alive. It's the spirit that shows that the body's alive. 3:1, not many of you should presume to be teachers, another example of maxim. We aren't getting all the maxims, by the way, but we have a couple more here. 4:7, submit yourselves to God, resist the devil, he'll flee from you. 4:10, humble yourselves before the Lord, he'll lift you up. 4:17, anyone who knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it sins. And then in the last chapter 5, is anyone of you in trouble? He should pray. Is anyone happy? Let him sing songs of praise. Is anyone of you sick? He should call the elders. And then down in 16, the prayer of a righteous man is powerful and effective. And then finally in 20, whoever turns a sinner from the error of his way will save him from death and cover over a multitude of sins. So there are examples, many of them, as I say, I don't think we've got near all of them caught here with the green highlighting, but maxims or proverbs. We look briefly at historical examples or sayings of famous people in blue, and none of those on the first panel or the second panel. On the third panel, 2:20, was not our ancestor Abraham considered righteous for what he did when he offered up his son Isaac on the altar? So Abraham and Isaac come up in the very crucial passage of Abraham about to offer up Isaac before God intervenes. And then in 2:25, in the same way, was not even Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them in a different direction? So historical examples, and for James and Paul, these come out of the Old Testament. So Abraham, Isaac, Rahab, next panel hasn't got any, next panel, is 5:10, brothers, an example of patience in the face of suffering, teach prophets. And then you've heard of Job's perseverance down in 11, so the prophets and Job. And then in 5:17, Elijah was a man like us. He prayed earnestly. It would not rain. It did not rain on the land for 3.5 years. So more examples then. So Abraham, Isaac, Rahab, the prophets, Job, Elijah, etc. All of those in the letter to James. Go back again and look last of all at orange irony. And on the first panel, 1:20, man's anger does not bring about the righteous life that God desires. I think it's an understatement for irony, huh? Man's anger very easily falls into sin. So got a little ironic statement there by James, I believe. And 2:6. You've insulted the poor. Is it not the rich who are exploiting you? That looks like that's probably irony or sarcasm. The people you shouldn't expect to exploit you because they got money. They don't need your money. They are in fact the ones who exploit Christians. And frankly, it's pointing to rich people who have gotten rich by unsavory means, if you like, but also points to a danger that rich people have, as they have influence in the world in a way that poor people typically don't, and they often misuse it. They're sinners like average wealth people and poor people are. Here in 3:7, I think we have an example of irony. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and creatures of the sea are being tamed and have been tamed by man, but no man can tame the tongue. It is restless evil full of deadly poison. The irony that humans can tame all sorts of wild animals, but they can't tame their tongue. Well, that's about got it for the irony. And that's our quick tour. One could certainly do work with other things. And if you want to walk back through these panels and look at other labels I've got written in pen in the margins, you'll see examples of other things besides those that we suggest here for what's going on. Examples of amplification and examples of censure and things of that sort. Well, that's the end of our little talk here on the diatribe genre, and then how it's exemplified in the letter of James. And our closing panel here is to be on the lookout for these kind of features. They'll help you understand what's going on. If you make categorize these and put them together, you can then see how James and Paul are arguing, some of the techniques they use, and that can both help us in suggesting some techniques we can use. Yeah, we're talking into a different culture, but there's still some features that relate to how you give a talk and what sort of things grab people and what sort of things convey well orally and that sort of thing. And those can be helpful for us to see here as well.